Welcome to the Locate 852 podcast, bringing you insights on how you can build and scale your business with social platforms. Hosted by the leading Facebook ad strategist in Hong Kong, entrepreneur, branding expert, and the founder of Locate 852, Chris Chung.
Jay, thank you so much for being on the show. Super excited to finally connect with you and learn from one of the best of the best. Usually we start from the very, very beginning, from young Jay, baby Jay, all the way up until now, but I like to take a different approach this time and dive right into the deep end. Can you please expand more at the kind of like the core simplest form of the concept of taking your business profits beyond exponential and how that applies?
Sure. Yeah, so my life has been an accidental exploration of how to make performance multiply in every facet of the revenue side of the business. I'm not an operator. I don't have good management skills, Chris, nor do I understand, any kind of supply side. But on the revenue side, I'm extremely knowledgeable because I've been blessed to be involved in about 1,000 industries. And I've been able to see how to take the performance of the revenue side and more specifically, the bottom line, geometrically. Everyone talks about a 10x moonshot, but they're talking about your revenue. I can pretty much get the bottom line to grow, and I have done it geometrically many times. But over my career, almost every year, I would identify and refine one distinction, one proprietary concept that I would come up with, which on its own separately could multiply bottom line by sometimes orders of magnitude. And after about 40 years of doing this and coming up with now about 90 different categories, I curiously wondered, well, Jesus, if you got all these different separate ways that can make the bottom line grow geometrically, any one of them, what is geometry times geometry times geometry? And I always wondered, but probably stupidly, Chris, I never looked it up. Then one day, just in curiosity, I was sitting around, I looked it up and found out that mathematically, it is a given that there are at least five gradients of performance above and beyond exponentiation. It's called hyper-operationalizing. And without being too esoteric, what it just means is that there's five levels above geometric, above exponential. It's tetration, heptation, hexation, pentation, octation. And I don't know how you would do it, but the zeros would be, to the moon and back. And so I realized that if you could actually mathematically perform above exponential, you should never allow at least the profit performance, my office is on the runway of a private airport. You should never let your bottom line performance ever operate in the incremental zone if the same effort or less, the same time or less, the same access to the market or less, the same advertising expenditures, sales staff, same number of leads, the same transactions could be easily made to perform at least exponentially. And that's sort of in a simple or a complex sense, that's the origin of that philosophy. And then I started realizing that I could teach taking your business profits beyond exponential, and that it's much easier when you understand it to grow the bottom line over the top. Most people think there has to be a linear correlation. It's got to be symmetrical. The top line's got to grow by X for the bottom line to grow by X and or Y by whatever it is, a correlation. It's not true. You can make the bottom line grow 2, 3, 4, 5 times faster than the top line if you understand all the ways to do it.
And why are we as entrepreneurs just like a human hedge fund?
It's sort of interesting, Chris. If you think about a hedge fund, and a lot of people go, I don't understand hedge funds, but in its simplest form, a regular hedge fund or a fund of fund, it is an investment vehicle that has a portfolio. And in that portfolio, there may be many different investment classes. They are placed in that portfolio with specific intention to produce certain returns, yield, with certain risk factors, and many portfolios have many different investment classes and different levels of risk and reward being produced. The goal of a hedge fund is to produce what's called alpha, and alpha means performance above and beyond the mean, the norm. So if you look at a life, if you look at a business, if you look at a body, if you look at a relationship, if you look at anything, you can say, okay, I am an investor, whether I recognize it or not. Every day, every minute, every action, every decision is an investment I am making in all kinds of things. My business, and within your business, you know, the direction of it, you know, the expansion of it, the expenditures in it, the commitment to it, the time, the effort, the emotion, the market you're targeting, the people you're hiring, you know, the goal, the game you're playing, whether it's an income game, whether it's an asset game, whether it's an acquisition game. And when you realize all the different things going on in a business, a career, a life, you realize that there are a lot of different elements, and each one you can analogize to an investment class. And if you are, in fact, investing, which you are, whether you like it or not, you should want to know what kind of relative yield you're getting for that investment versus what kind of risk you are unknowingly accepting. And you might have 40% of your portfolio invested in something that's giving you a minuscule yield, and maybe 10% is invested in something giving you an extraordinary yield. And when you evaluate it, you might want to severely adjust, because investment funds, hedge funds, are always adjusting their portfolio mix to market, to economy, to, you know, to risk. And then you got to know what's the game you're playing. What is, if you're playing to achieve alpha, and why would you not want to get everything you can out of either your business, your career, your life, your relationship, your body, you know, your anything, every day, you know, your breath, your interaction. So if that isn't your goal, I would suggest you want to evaluate whether or not it should be. If it should be, you need to know how you are investing in your portfolio and whether those investments are giving you higher risk than you want, you know, lower yield than you want, the wrong mix than you want, and always be constantly adjusting. Does that explain it?
Beautifully. A lot of the listeners of this show is obviously, just like I shared with you previously, was a younger demographic, people that are thinking about pursuing entrepreneurship, people that are just starting entrepreneurship. So I'd love for you to take us all the way back to baby Jay. What was your upbringing like, and how were you as a child?
I came from a lower middle class, very loving Jewish family. I lived in the Midwest, Indianapolis. I had a loving mother that didn't work, a father who was a salesperson. He never made a lot of money, but he was a very quality human being with very high ethos, enormous integrity, a very nice work ethic, but he wasn't driven. He worked 8 to 5 and stopped, and he was a very nice man. They were reasonably religious, but not overt. I lived in, as I say, a lower middle class, but it was not bad, just not a lot of wealth. We would walk, you know, 10, 15 blocks to go to the bus to go to school. I was somewhat entrepreneurial when I was young. I was a good student, but not a massively great student. I didn't go to college. I'm not formally educated. I got married the first time when I was 18 and had 2 children at 20, and the need of somebody 40. And basically defaulted into entrepreneurship because of that, because most people wouldn't give me a real paying job. They would give me an eat what you kill type of a situation where you got paid on performance. And the advantage of that was that I wasn't relegated to 8 to 5, because they didn't care if I worked 1 minute or 14 hours. They just cared that if I made something happen, they had to give me a share. And if I didn't, they didn't. So I was able to experience lots of different jobs, unfortunately, in lots of different industries. And that gave me the context of realizing that people in one industry don't necessarily have a clue how people in other industries think or act, transact business, strategy, marketing, advertising, access vehicles, meaning the mechanisms you use to reach your market, anything. And I was able at a very young age to basically take elements from industries that I had been involved in, but with mechanisms and approaches that people in the industry I might have been in right now had never been exposed to. They were very common in those other industries, but totally uncommon in the industries I introduced them to. And everyone thought I was brilliant, and I was nothing more, frankly, than the one-eyed man in the land of the blind, but it worked very well. And then I progressed and progressed and progressed from there. So it was, you know, not a spectacular childhood, but not a volatile childhood. And it just was a short childhood because I got married very young, and then I was thrust into the business world with no real skill set, training, or even maturity. So it was interesting.
So I know you've had experienced quite a bit of success, even in your early to mid-20s already. From being thrown into the deep end and having to perform on results, what were some of the lessons that you had to learn to experience that success in your early 20s?
Well, I mean, it was that I learned lifetime value very young. I learned the value of repetitive business, of doing something once and having somebody buy over and over again, and how much more valuable that was than just a static one-time transaction. I understood that you could spend a significant amount or all of the first sale if you had a lot of repeat sales following it. I learned that if you didn't take the risk away from a transaction, it was harder for people to say yes than no. It was harder to say yes, they would say no. But if you took the risk away, it was easier to say yes than no. I learned that advertising medias at the time all had underutilized capacity. And if you could find a meaningful way to convince them of the merit of your proposition, back then you could get them to run ads for you on a result basis instead of a paid basis. I learned that, when I started, it was Icy Hot was one of the first things I did, but I learned lots of things. I was involved in accounting in parts. I was involved in collections. I was involved in the travel business and membership. I was involved in associations, the Indiana Meat Packers and Grocers Association Independent. I learned all about the passion, the fear, the problems that different kinds of businesses struggled with. And I was able to see how entrepreneurs usually tried to be islands and do everything. I was also able, very blessedly, to learn from mentors who were inherently very, very masterful at identifying voids that certain segments of the market or niches were not receiving, and they were able to fill it, or under performance that people were getting where they were able to make it better, or groups of the market that bigger companies were sort of dissing or demeaning and were able to address. I was early, you won't know this because you're too young, but I was able to be part of the first wave of people who did credible and ethical telephone marketing. Before that, people didn't really sell on the phone. And then there was a period where before where we are now, you would pay a lot of money to have a phone line that reached a certain geography. There were band one, band two, band five. Some would be your local city, your local state. Some would be your contiguous state. Some would be East Coast, West Coast. And we became very, very, very masterful early in at qualitative B2B selling by phone when it was very credible. I used automatic typewriters and personalized letters before anybody ever knew how to do them. What else is interesting? I got into the lead generating business very early and was able to learn variation. I worked with three different major companies who were on the cutting edge of learning and using variation. One was the Deming organization that was the father. He was the father, excuse the noise, of process improvement, optimization, highest and best use theory. I worked with a company called Qualpro that was at the time the largest multivariable testing organization in the world. They would test all kinds of variations, different ways of selling, different ways of post-sale, either reselling, cancellation, abatement. They would work on retail testing, whether you have products at the top of the aisle, the bottom of the aisle, how many SKUs, the end of the aisle. They would test different ways of saying something when you come into a store. And I learned all that. I worked for the largest professional strategic litigation consulting firm that helped attorneys and corporations who were in the middle of very high stakes litigation figure out how to command advantage ethically, whether it was the venue, the jury selection, how to position your client's position literally so that the jury would be empathic or empathetic, how to graphically demonstrate pain and suffering or minimize it. I did a lot of stuff when I was younger.
So having such vast experience, looking back now during your 20s, what would you contribute your success? If you had to boil that down to a few factors, what would you contribute that to? Was it your curiosity to always learn? Was it a matter of focus and execution? Was it failing forward? Was it having someone that's been there in order to teach you what to do and what not to do? What are some of the factors that you think really contributed to the success that you had when you were especially younger?
Yeah, well, I mean, all of the above, but probably if you had to distill a couple of the drivers or the fuelers or the just the propellants, one would be I have hopeless curiosity. I am obsessively and fascinatingly intrigued with anything and everybody. And I want to learn how every kind of business operates. I want to learn, you know, their methodology, their mindset, their drivers, their models. I want to understand the mind of their market. I created what's called funnel vision versus tunnel vision, which is borrowing success approaches from outside your industry and integrating them into hybrids. I think I've been blessed probably partially because of all the experiences, but maybe how my brain is wired, with enormously high levels of what's called pattern recognition. So I can see a scenario and I can relate it to elements from lots of past empirical life experiences. So I can adapt, borrow, extrapolate. And I think that comes from real experience. I think I've been blessed because I can take very complex understandings and distill them down to relatively simple, lowest common denominator explanations, which help people literally embrace it when they understand it and appreciate it. I think I've been taught strategy as opposed to just tactics, and I understand the higher leverage in it. I think I've been very blessed to learn true value creation as value is defined, Chris, by the audience, not by the owner of the business, which is just a very, very big distinction. I think I've been blessed because in the course of my older work, I've helped over 300 really world-class experts, none of which came to me for help with their methodology or their intellectual capital, they are products or IP. They came to me for help commanding more value, higher prices, more advantage, but I had to learn a distillation of what they were all about. So I got bombarded with, you know, Stephen Covey, Stephen R. Covey, Tony Robbins, all these people had to teach me what they were all about before I could help them, you know, command more money from it. So that was pretty cool. Along the way, I should probably tell you this because you have young, either existing or aspiring entrepreneurs. I was part of Entrepreneur Magazine when it first came out. Nobody even knew what the word entrepreneur meant. We had to send, this is before the internet, we had to send our mailing pieces out literally on the outside. We would have the Webster's Dictionary, our dictionary, I don't know what you use in Asia, the Webster's Dictionary definition and phonetic pronunciation of the word entrepreneur because nobody even knew how to say it, much less what it meant. So I came pretty early in the entrepreneurial game. I don't know if that answers your question.
Perfectly. You mentioned, you just mentioned that value is based on the audience and not the owner. Can you share more upon that?
Sure. I mean, what you value and what you want to get out of this conversation may be totally different than what I value and want to give you. And it can be in answers. It can be in objective outcome. I don't want, but if I was like many people, I might want to titillate in order to get people to want to have a relationship where they can pay me money. Or I may want to tell you about something that is currently very interesting to me, whereas you're not interested in that because theoretically you're an advocate for your audience and they want to know right now some, we'll call them seminals, some foundational stuff. I learned early in the game, the first thing you have to do is examine, explore, appreciate, understand, respect, and really acknowledge how the other side sees life, because we're not, no two people are having the same discussion. We're not defining words the same because no two people had the same background. Their mental images of a word or word phrase don't conjure up the same. So the first thing you have to do is get out of your own unilateral way of thinking and say, what I value may have nothing whatsoever to do with what you value. So you got to get into the mind of your market.
One of the key points of the strategy of preeminence is that it is your job to help provide focus, and that focus is clarity, and clarity gives power. Do you find that focus is something that all younger entrepreneurs lack nowadays, just because of the way that people are doing, younger entrepreneurs are becoming younger and younger, young people are starting digital businesses, that focus and the fundamentals of focus is lacking?
Yes. You want me to just answer yes and move on? Ask me a different question. What would they embellish?
Yeah, I would love to see how do you think with the digital?
I think there are three forces of negativity that impact the richness of the entrepreneurial experience that a young person should want to achieve for themselves, create for others. One is there are a lot of people out there that erroneously convince young entrepreneurs that in order to be successful, they just have to be good tacticians. They don't have to have good strategy. They don't have to be great value creators. They don't really have to fully appreciate their audience, that they can basically be pretty superficial in their connection and it will still work, which I don't think is true. Number two, this idea of limited attention span, I think is a is a deterrent because, you know, there's a wonderful, wonderful book that came out a couple of years ago called Range, R-A-N-G-E. And it's a guy who's a pretty well-known, I can't remember his
name. David Epstein?
Right. And the premise of it is that today, the people that are going to own the rest of the 21st century are the ones that have the most diverse understanding of stuff, because historic understanding is not, what's happening now has no precedent. Hindsight has got some usefulness and insight, but foresight is only going to work if you can process it through a lens of an enormous spectrum of empirical understanding. And most people aren't interested in anything but what they're interested in. And that's the kiss of limited achievement, because you can't really, breakthroughs, if you understand where breakthroughs come from, thinking breakthroughs, business breakthroughs, life breakthroughs, they usually come from outside your realm. If you think about it, and I'm going to go old school because it's easier than talking about some current things, you can probably counter with some current examples, but fiber optics, which totally transformed telecommunication, was not discovered by telecommunication people. It was aerospace, and it was borrowed. Federal Express created a whole overnight delivery industry by borrowing what's called the hub and spoke check clearing process that the Federal Reserve Bank uses to clear checks in the United States early, so nobody will bounce a check. Bouncing a check, if they don't know what it means, is writing a check that has no funds in it. Rogaine was created out of a pimple medicine that they saw grew hair. Viagra was not designed for sexual enhancement. It was designed for heart. The ballpoint pen or the roll-on deodorant was borrowed from the other. The most successful baby buggy in the world that has a collapsible wheels borrowed that methodology from airplanes. I mean, go on and on and on, but most people, they're only interested in a very limited spectrum, and it makes them, in my opinion, very incapable of navigating all the opportunities, challenges, both in business, in career, in human interaction, that the future unerringly is going to bring upon them.
Having such an incredible career and being the $21.7 billion man working over 1,000 industries, what are some of a few of the core lessons that you want to make sure that you pass on to your kids in regards to success in life and success in business?
Well, first thing is that every human being, with little exception, Chris, no matter their status or circumstance, deserves to be treated with relevancy, dignity, and significance. Second is that anytime you interact with any other person for any amount of time, large or small, your job is to leave them better off because you were in their life. Stephen R. Covey, the late Stephen R. Covey, said, seek to understand first before you try to be understood. The next is that most people have, we talked about cars. I like cars, but only as a therapeutic release from the day-to-day challenges and intensity. But I learned long ago that they aren't going to change your life. Once you get something like a Ferrari, the biggest thrill you get is the vicarious thrill you give somebody who drives by who wishes they owned it. Because after a while, it's just a noisy, clunky car. It costs a fortune when it breaks. You got to pay $25 instead of $3 when you park it at the front of the restaurant. People resent you and want to key it, and it costs thousands of dollars to fix it. A brake job is $5,000. I had a Bentley, and it needed $30,000 of shock absorbers. It was used and it wasn't going to add one penny to its value. The insurance goes up. But I think most people are obsessed with an end product, and they think that when they achieve it, whether it's the woman or guy of their dreams, whether it's the fastest growing business, whether it's $1 million or $10 million or $100 million, whether it's toys, whether it's things like a house, that alone is going to change their life and instantaneously, Chris, and I was thinking about David Meltzer, instantaneously, you know, the heavens are going to open and the angels are going to sing and Nirvana is going to, you know, befall them. It's BS. The process is all there is. This is as good as it gets. So you should enjoy everything, and even setbacks you should learn from, and you should basically embrace life for all its magnificent wonder. And it's not always fun, and it's not always fair, but it's always fascinating. Those are some lessons I think that are probably, they're superior to just business building lessons, because if you're building a business for the wrong reason, it's going to be very anticlimactic, and there's nothing about it that's going to be satisfying, or, I mean, enriching is going to be depleting the, you know, what's really rich. I mean, richness, wealth is denominated in many different levels. You know, it's financially, it's health, it's balance, it's fulfillment, it's the sense of contribution, satisfaction, you know, exhilaration just for being alive. And if you don't have an integration and a pretty well balanced, you're lopsided, and something always is going to blow.
Jay, you've done so many different interviews, from the big stage to the ones with Sean Dill, David Meltzer, Steve Sims. What is one question that I should have asked you that I didn't?
I think, you know, what's if you didn't, you know, go to the business or anything, if you took everything else away from me and I only had one methodology or concept of mine that I could use to create success in the business world, not necessarily in the other elements, but assuming I was willing to have the rest of the balanced life that I think is important, what would that one essence, what would that one concept be, and why?
Would you care to share that with us?
It'd be a variation of a strategic alliance, joint venture, power partnering, co-branding. It would be figuring out who else already has a trusted, hard won, H-A-R-D-W-O-N, meaning they had to work their ass off and spend a lot of time, effort, money to generate a relationship with the same target audience that you want to reach, and how you can structure with them some kind of a collaboration that allows you to ethically get them to encourage and compel and endorse your product, service, company to their audiences, plural. I've generated billions of dollars for clients doing that. I generated $250 million of seminars for myself doing that, usually with very little or no front end money or risk. There are many ways to do it. It's much more sophisticated than the affiliate concept that is bantered around and abused today. It's got all kinds of intricate assets. To give you one example that I talk about a lot because it's really wonderful. Many, many years ago, speaking of the Asian market, I did seminars in China. And I'll never forget the first time I went there, we were doing very expensive for the time seminars in Shenzhen. You obviously know where Shenzhen is. It's across the bridge or whatever you call it. We had, you know, maybe 850 people there for a 3-day seminar. And at the end, I always opened up the mic for questions and problems and issues that were proposed through translation. A young man, literally about your age, came to the mic and said, "Jay, what do you do if you're too small and the bank won't lend you money to grow?" And I, as I would always do, I said, "Well, tell me more." And he said, I'm a small local motorcycle manufacturer. Now, only in China can you be local motorcycle. Maybe it's 100 million city that you're in. And he said, if I had the money, I would go all over Asia. I would build a factory. I would open offices in every country. I'd hire salespeople. I'd recruit dealers. They'd be selling my motorcycles everywhere. I'd be very successful. I said, and I irritated him. I said, it's okay. Well, I don't understand the problem. And he got really mad. He goes, I told you the bank won't lend me money to grow. And I said, you don't need money. And he goes, what do you mean? And I said, your problem is always going to be the solution to somebody else's bigger problem. You just have to learn what it is and who they are. I said, go all over Asia, go on a road trip and find someone who is in a compatible, not a competitive field, and has the same profile as you are looking for of distributors, retailers, whatever, and figure out a collaboration. Find somebody who's got a huge factory that's underutilizing it and do some kind of collaboration. And it took me, what, a minute to say that? And then I left. And about 15 months later, Chris, I came back, and the same young man who was frustrated is now at the mic, and now he's smiling. We call it the Cheshire Cat, you know, like somebody... So he ate the canary. He was just really like on cloud nine. It was just effervescing. And he said, I did what you said. And I don't remember, because my whole life is answering questions, solving problems, dealing with complex issues. So I said, what did I tell you? He told me, I said, what'd you do? Because I went all over Asia. When I got to Kuala Lumpur, KL, I found Asia's largest lawnmower manufacturer. They had a huge factory. It was underutilizing the second shift. We made a deal. They had offices in 10 countries. They had dozens of salespeople, thousands of dealers. We made a deal where all I had to do was bring the tools and dies. And if you don't know what that is, everybody, they are the metal that forges the parts that come together for putting a product together, the assembly, the pieces. Said I had to bring the tools and dies, teach their people. He provided, the factory, the equipment, all the machinery, the people. He had the salespeople, the dealers. I had to train them and teach them how to recruit the dealers. I had to teach them how to sell the dealers on selling motorcycles. I had to teach the dealers. He said, in our first year together, with almost no out-of-pocket investment, we both made over $10 million. So you just have to think differently, but strategic alliances, if you understand them, joint ventures, I call it power partnering, endorsement relationships, co-branding, referral deals. I mean, there's so many things like that. You don't need capital to grow. You just need to understand who's already got a trusted, very credible, and directly accessible relationship with the same audience that you want to reach, and how to motivate them ethically to direct that audience to your company, product, service, and make it meaningful to that other person, the influencer, to do it for you. If you know how, you can build a huge business overnight for no investment.
Jay, my last question is, if you were to leave myself one piece of advice on succeeding in the business realm, what would that be?
It would be a couple of things, probably. I'll give you two pieces. One is commit yourself to learning everything you can about everything you can, because you will be able to think at a depth, breadth, and dimension that is so much above and beyond everyone you're competing against, that you will have absolute advantage. And that's something we teach, is how to gain absolute advantage in everything you do. Number two is seek to understand the market you're trying to serve at a clear level of understanding and empathy, so you can serve their needs better, whether it means adding more, more protection, greater warranty, more bonuses, more My understanding, and it'll make your marketing better, your selling better, your value proposition better, your delivery better, your fulfillment better, and then probably a third one is always, why do something once if the same effort or less, the same time or less, can build a relationship that you can monetize ethically over and over and over again? Because one way it's transactional, the other way it's you built an asset. And you're an investor. You're investing in relationships. And you should be, there's two kinds of investors, Chris. There's a 2D and a 3D investor. A 2D investor only says, okay, I got revenue, I got expenses. When it's done, I got profit. A 3D doesn't look that way. He or she looks at every transaction as bringing assets that have the ability to produce residual ongoing yield. And when you look at it on a yield basis, like a private equity firm or a hedge fund would, you're playing a totally different, much more sophisticated and powerful game than everyone you compete against. So there's some thoughts.
Jay, thank you so much for being on the show. For the people that want to follow you, keep up with what you're doing, potentially if they even can work with you, where's the best place to find you?
I mean, we got a website, abraham.com. And they're welcome to, you know, go there. There's a lot of stuff on it. If they're very large and they ever want to explore it, they can write me at jay@abraham.com. And there's a ton of stuff we give away. And then we've got, you know, a few things we sell. But yeah, I mean, I don't do very much Facebook and I don't do very much Instagram. And I'm a very private person. You're not going to see my life, you know, pictorially depicted. But I have great empathic adoration for anyone who has entrepreneurial aspirations and they tie it to extreme value creation. The more you want to create value for the other side, and that value is in alignment with what the other side treasures, the more admiration I have for you. So anyhow, good. I hope it helped.
Jay, thank you so much for being on the show.
You're very welcome.